So good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scaminini and the co-host here is Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and of the hosts and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Well, today is our annual program on the top news stories of 2016 to 17 that didn't make the news. These are contained in the annual book published by Project Censored that was published just last week. So we wanted to tell the public immediately what Project Censored has identified as the news that didn't make the news over the last year. Let me start with an excerpt from Project Censored's website. The presentation of the top 25 stories of 2016 to 2017 extends the tradition originated by Professor Carl Jensen and his Sonoma State University students in 1976. While reflecting how the expansion of the project to include affiliate faculty and students from campuses across North America has made the project even more diverse and robust. During this year's cycle, Project Censored reviewed over 300 validated independent news stories, representing the collective efforts of 310 college students and 27 professors from 12 college and university campuses that participate in the affiliate program. So our guest is Andy Lee Roth, board member of the Media Freedom Foundation that sponsors Project Censored and publishes the annual book titled Censored. In this case, Censored 2018 has just been published last week. Andy is associate director of Project Censored and co-editor of several editions of the Censored series. He has a PhD and teaches sociology at Sonoma State University and some of the community colleges in the area. He's worked with Project Censored since 2005 and published chapters on media coverage of the U.S. drone program, international water issues, and news photographs depicting the human cost of war. So let's have a look at the news that didn't make the news over the last year. Andy Roth, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thanks so much, Steve. Thanks so much, Annie. It's a pleasure to join you once again.
So can we begin with just a brief overview of Project Censored in recent years? It's founded back in the 70s, and is it continuing then with the Media Freedom Foundation and anything new about organizational stuff in the last few years?
Just that we're continuing to expand so that this year's book represents, as you just mentioned, literally hundreds of college and university students from, in this case, this particular year, a dozen campuses. But over the past few years, as faculty members' teaching loads rotate, we really have close to two dozen college and university campuses across not only the United States, but really North America, that are engaged in this ongoing effort to document the stories that the corporate media are missing or distorting, but that we know about thanks to the crucial, essential work of independent journalists and independent news organizations across the country and in some cases around the world.
Great. Well, we identified 9 of the 25 that are in the book, and we'll be real lucky to get through those 9 even today on the program. But let's jump into a few. The one that I picked out first that piqued my interest is titled "Fossil Fuel Industry Colonizing U.S. Universities." So, give us a little background on that one.
Yeah, and before I do, just real quickly, let me put in a pitch. For any of these stories, or if listeners are interested in any of the other top 25 stories from this year's list that we don't get a chance to discuss today, all these stories are posted in capsule summary form on the Project Censored website. So you can, for either if you want full references on any of the stories that we're about to talk about, or if you're interested to see what the other stories are, have a look at the website where we archive all the top 25 stories, not only from this year, but going all the way back to the first year that Carl Jensen created the project, all the way back to 1976.
My goodness, so, really? That far back?
Yeah.
Great.
So that is all online as a public resource that the project makes available at no charge. We want this information out there. So as far as this idea of colonization of our American, of United States universities and college campuses by the fossil fuel industry, this is a story that originates with two researchers at Stanford and Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Benjamin Franta and Jeffrey Supan, who reported in The Guardian in March of this year that the very experts that we tend to assume to be objective and the very centers of research that we assume to be independent are, in effect, connected with the very industry that the public, the general public, believes these experts and institutes are objectively and independently studying. And so the result is not simply that we have a conflict of interest among these university-sponsored and accredited individuals and organizations, but that, in effect, the industry, the fossil fuel industry, by which we mean, oil, gas, and coal companies, as well as utilities and the people who invest in these entities, the industry projects get the appearance of neutrality and credibility that is associated with something like, the aura, the image of Stanford or Massachusetts Institute of Technology and so forth.
Wow, yeah, and I understand they have some kind of clauses going for them so that you can't have guests on the campus that contradict what they're saying about the fossil fuel being wonderful, and it's very difficult for students to get the whole story.
Right, and so, a lot of times this is presented as a kind of a reasonable, like these are matters of debate. So, for instance, Franta and Supran in their Guardian piece talk about an event that took place at Harvard in February of this year. The event was sponsored by the Shell Oil Company, but that sponsorship, that financial sponsorship, was not disclosed to the public. And the title of this event is part and parcel of what, just along the lines of what you just said, Annie. The title of the event was Finding Energy's Rational Middle. And as Franta and Supran notice, this language, this tactic of promoting a, quote, rational middle between, in other words, total dependence on non-renewable energy and total independence from it, is a tactic that the fossil fuel industry uses to effectively undermine the shift to renewable energy sources, that there needs to be a rational middle. So, for instance, at this Harvard event, there was a documentary that was produced by Shell that featured many people who were connected to the fossil fuel industry, but those connections were not disclosed. So you had, for instance, a person who's identified in the film as the executive director of energy and sustainability at the University of California, Davis, which sounds like, oh, that's someone we can trust and count on to give us a perspective. But it wasn't disclosed that that same person is also a member of the U.S. National Petroleum Council. So in the film, when that spokesperson says, we need to be realistic that we're going to use fossil fuels now because in the end we are, that's a form of corporate propaganda, but it's being presented, obviously not as a partisan position, but as an expert analysis.
I just want to digress just for a second here. We're getting a lot of calls in the studio, and I think it's because Rich had asked people to call with their information on the fire. Right now, you should be calling the office, 895-2324, with the information that you have. And thanks for that interruption. We'll have some more, I'm sure.
So, oh, what a tangled web we weave with these corporate influence here. Annie mentioned contracts. Does anybody gotten a hold of one of these contracts to see what they actually say between the corporations and universities?
Well, we know from Franta and Supran's report and others like it, some of the very large figures that are involved. So MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has received $185 from David Koch, the climate change denial financier. He's actually a life member of MIT's board.
Mm-hmm.
Stanford's Global Climate and Energy Project is funded by ExxonMobil. At UC Berkeley, the Energy Biosciences Institute was initiated in a deal in 2007 that came with $500 million from BP. And as a matter of fact, BP appoints half of the voting members of the governance board for the Energy Biosciences Institute at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
So These aren't contracts per se, but they are financial ties that suggest, again, in line with the main thesis of this Guardian report, that there's been, in effect, a kind of a colonization, right? It's not explicit, it's not overt, it's not public, unless you dig and look at, well, where, you know, where is the financing coming from?
Yeah.
It's important to emphasize, though, that I think Franta and Soutrain also say there are solutions to this you know, this, quote, colonization. A lot of times when we see the episodic coverage of financial ties at particular universities, we don't get anything like a perspective on, well, what could be done about this? And their article did call for greater disclosures of financial funding from the fossil fuel industry to reduce conflicts of interest, mm-hmm. and prioritizing sponsors and personnel, in other words, researchers, who are not as conflicted. And so those sound like, you know, they may sound like easier said than done proposals, but the kind of clarity there is, I think, something that is encouraging. And the coverage that emphasizes solutions is, of course, important if we're going to be informed about how to proceed.
Indeed. So the figure was $185 million from David Koch went to MIT.
Correct.
We don't know exactly what strings are attached, but we can certainly extrapolate from some of the reports and how they report news there. And then $500 million, $500 million,
oh my God,
from the energy or to the Energy Biosciences Institute at UC Berkeley, and
right.
that's and, from. Go ahead.
And so, just to fill that out, like that, when that deal was made, there was some coverage in the corporate press. But that coverage tended to emphasize the benefits of the partnership with BP for UC Berkeley,
yeah.
right? So, and when, so in 2010, not long after that Berkeley BP partnership, the Center for American Progress released a study that documented, you know, the strong grip on university research. And again, that generated a little bit of corporate media coverage, but mm-hmm. but nothing on, you know, let's just say the coverage has not been as systematic as the corporate influence on the research and the public understanding of climate science mm-hmm. has been.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move to a different topic here. One of the issues that is on my mind generally is climate change and such, and there is an interesting article on the lawsuit by youth, and they invoke constitutional grounds for climate protection. Could you tell us a little about that report?
Yeah, this is, I think, a fascinating story and one that everyone should be tracking into the new year ahead. And we should all mark our calendars for February 5th, 2018, when this case will go to trial at a federal district court in Eugene. The case I'm talking about is Juliana versus United States, which was originally brought by 21 plaintiffs between the ages at the time of 8 and 19. And they argued that the federal government and the fossil fuel industry have knowingly endangered the plaintiffs by promoting the burning of fossil fuels, and that this violates their constitutional and public trust rights. So this has been challenged many times by the fossil fuel industries since the Trump administration came into power, by the Trump administration. Judges have consistently denied motions to dismiss the case, and it really is, I think, a groundbreaking lawsuit. One of the reports that we covered at Project Censored called this this lawsuit was the first of its kind because it's linking the causes of climate change with the United States Constitution. And it wasn't just reporters or people at Project Censored saying this. In the April 2016 motion to dismiss the case, the judge who denied that motion, Judge Thomas Coffin, wrote, "The intractability of the debates before Congress and state legislatures and the alleged valuing of short-term economic interest, despite the cost to human life, necessitates that the courts evaluate the constitutional parameters of the action or inaction taken by the government." And so As a subsequent judge noted, this is no ordinary lawsuit, right? It's of a different order than the typical environmental case. The allegations are that defendants' actions and inactions, whether or not they violate any specific statutory duty, have profoundly damaged the planet in a way that threatens the plaintiff's fundamental constitutional rights to life and liberty.
Wow. I love this. This is a future fighting back. It's wonderful.
Yes. Yes. One of the plaintiffs is quoted in one of the stories that we covered here. Our generation will continue to be a force for the world, said at the time 16-year-old plaintiff Victoria Barrett.
Yeah.
That's great news.
So now, what's going to happen? I think this story has not gotten a lot of attention initially when the case was first filed. It's gotten a little more coverage in the corporate press now, although, you know, MSNBC described the lawsuit as unusual and long on symbolism, but, quote, unlikely to win. But the reason I mentioned at the outset, we should all mark our calendars for February 5th. We're anticipating that at courthouses all across the country, there are going to be children out on the steps of those courthouses, not just in Eugene, right, but all across the country, expressing solidarity with the plaintiffs of this case. And that kind of imagery is going to mean that this story will finally get the kind of widespread corporate media coverage that it so richly deserves. We'll have to wait and see about the slant of that coverage. But I think those images are going to compel the major network and cable TV stations to cover this story in a way that will bring it to much wider attention.
Okay, we'll keep that date in mind. And let me mention one other detail you covered briefly, that there's been a couple of judges that have, have refused to deny the motion, or in the second case, a judge affirmed the Coffin's rule. You mentioned this fellow, Judge
exactly.
Thomas Coffin. So it was about 6 months later. That was late last year, which is about a year ago now. But a U.S. District Court affirmed his ruling. So there's, you know, been opportunities for judges to throw this out, and they have not. So
yeah, no, it's making its way through despite the best efforts of, you know, the fossil fuel industry has desperately tried to duck out of this case. The Trump administration, as I mentioned, has tried to, when the plaintiffs shifted from bringing the case against the Obama administration, and I shifted to Trump. Trump's administration immediately attempted to duck out of it, and the judges simply have not let them do so.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already, I think, a victory of sorts that this will be going to trial.
Okay, and we're talking February 5th, 2018.
Okay, well, related to climate change is another article titled Shell Understood Climate Change as Early as 1991 and Ignored It.
Yeah, this is a credit to people who dig for information that's been out there but's been buried, that it's gone down the memory hole. In this case, it's Jelpers Momers who obtained a copy of this 1991 documentary film that the Shell Oil Company produced and distributed called Climate of Concern. And the film, which people can go and find online and watch for themselves, I can briefly summarize as the film described in 1991 the potentially drastic consequences of climate change, including things that are, seem so self-evident to us today, extreme weather, flooding, famines, the potential for climate refugees. And the film commented that while many think that global warming is not yet certain, that the final proof, the waiting for final proof would be irresponsible, mm-hmm. according to the narrator of the Shell film. And the film went on to explain that a uniquely broad consensus of scientists had issued a serious warning in a report to the United Nations. That's what we now know today as the landmark climate change IPCC scientific assessment. And so Jelmer Momers, got an old video cassette of this documentary. They digitized it, and in partnership with a reporter at The Guardian, Damian Carrington, they released it along with a lot of other supporting documents. And so the need for action, Shell clearly understood as early as 1991. They were talking about ways that society could reduce carbon emissions, and the documentary discussed nuclear power, hydroelectric, solar, and wind power as alternatives. But as Momers and Carrington went on to report, since then, Shell has consistently undermined the production of renewable energy for its own financial gain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this isn't exactly on the subject directly, but why do they always put nuclear power under renewable? I mean, it's an extraction industry too, right? Okay, yeah. So that's,
yes, yeah. But I mean, the bigger point there, I mean, that is a crucial point and deserves a discussion of its own. But the bigger point is that, for instance, as The Guardian reported in April of 2015, right, Shell was involved in an effort. They were successfully lobbying to undermine European renewable energy targets ahead of a key agreement that was reached in 2014, right? So that Guardian report of 2015 documented how Shell was pursuing its own interests, its own investments, its own lucrative, model, even over and against, you know, what was known and publicized by the company.
Okay, planetary ruin takes a second seat or maybe a fifth seat to corporate profits.
And yeah. And all of us are just collateral damage for Shell and other companies that are just looking to maximize profits.
And before we move on from that, I wanted to go back, knowing I would be joining you on Corporations and Democracy today. I went back and dug out one of my favorite quotes from Alex Carey, who I don't know how many people know of Alex Carey and his work, but he was one of the pioneers in the study of corporate propaganda. In fact, Herman and Chomsky in their now classic Manufacturing Consent, that book Herman and Chomsky dedicated to Alex Carey. And in one of his own books, Taking the Risk Out of Democracy, Carey said that the 20th century had been characterized by three developments of great political importance. The first development was the growth of democracy. The second, he said, was the growth of corporate power. And the third development of the 20th century, he said, was the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy. And although Carey was talking about the 20th century, I think in many ways we can see, the first 17 years of the 21st century as a continuation of that very same dynamic, right? That the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate interests against the checks and balances of true, robust, grassroots democracy. So I think a lot of the stories that we've been talking about today and that we may talk about soon fit, a larger context for understanding them is in terms of that insight from Alex Carey.
Yeah, he's really called it. And I think people can go to TUC Radio's website. Mariah Gallardon has done some stuff on Alex Carey, I think. He really did.
Great.
He really did show us what was going on, and I hope somebody's noticing. At least Project Censored is helping to bring that to people's attention.
So to wrap up on that article, so it was 1991 when Shell Oil produced this internal documentary movie, and then since then they've ignored it. So amazing.
Yeah.
Worse than ignore, I think.
So there's a topic that interests me that's titled Judges Across U.S. Using, Right-Wing Money Promotes Model Legislation to Restrict Free Speech on University Campuses.
Mm-hmm. And, so, of course, as soon as we talk about free speech on university campuses, a lot of people are probably thinking of Mayo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter and Berkeley and so forth. Those have been the versions of free speech on university campuses that have been in the headlines and on the evening news. But this story, which is originally reported by Alex Koch for Alternet back in March of this year, is about the use of money and power to influence public policy that would suppress student dissent on those campuses. And what Koch documents is the efforts of the right-wing Goldwater Institute, which is also funded by Charles Koch and the Mercer family. And the Goldwater Institute has proposed model legislation that would seek to forestall student dissent on things, you know, when guest speakers come to talk about climate change or to oppose LGBTQ rights or to espouse hate speech. So the Goldwater Institute has proposed what they call the Campus Free Speech Act, which its stated aim is to uphold free speech principles and to ensure, quote, the fullest degree of free expression. But as Alternet reported, the model legislation doesn't consider protest or dissent to be free speech. Mm-hmm. It, in fact, proposes that students who engage in those activities as protected under the First Amendment would be subjected to a minimum of 1 year suspension or potentially expelled from their campuses if they engage their First Amendment rights.
Incredible. Okay, we are talking to Andy Lee Roth about the stories that Project Censored uncovered for last year for not being in the media. And as promised, we are going to take a little break here, and Alice is going to give us a fire update.
So let me remind listeners, we're talking with Andy Lee Roth about the annual book published by Project Censored. This one's called Censored 2018. And it's just been published last week and it's available now online. And I want to take a moment to mention that we had both lines were lit up just before the fire report with callers. And we just aren't going to have time today to take calls. But if there's something extremely urgent you want to get in here, call the main line, which is 895-2324. That's in area code 707. By the way, during the fires, it's been reported that the area code has been necessary for people to get through, unlike normal times when all the cell towers are working and you don't need one. So use the 707-895-2324.
Hey, I'm a digital disaster. Thank you, Alice, so much. And thanks to all of the staff and the news team, which have been working around the clock here at the station to keep you updated on the information. There's more than one disaster. I just want to inject another one. There are Puerto Ricans living in Mendocino County who are still mourning what happened to their island, their beautiful island. And Alex Negron is a Puerto Rican who is studying organic farming here in Comanche, and he's trying to get together a group of Puerto Ricans who are here locally. So far he's got just under a dozen, I think, and there's plenty more out there. If you would like to meet with Alex and his newly forming group to talk about solidarity with Puerto Rico, you can reach Alex at 707-937-0627. Sorry to mix up disasters here, but again, to help Puerto Rico, Alex Negron, 707-937-0627. I think they're thinking in terms of a sister city and maybe a fundraiser after we get through doing some work fundraising for our local fire disaster we're dealing with here. So thank you, Andy, for bearing with us here in our ongoing commotion over the people losing their homes and everything. It's been pretty horrible.
Yes. Well, you know, it's an inspiration to me to hear some of what's going on KZYX and Mendocino Public Radio because, of course, at Project Censored, we spend a lot of time talking about and celebrating and trying to rouse support for independent media and for public media. And of course, what everyone listening, not simply to this program, but to the station, appreciates is that in a time of crisis like this, with the wildfires, that your local public radio is your source of trustworthy information and vital communications. And so please support the station. Please support public radio there in Mendocino. It's essential. It's our basis for dealing well with present challenges and for being hopeful and optimistic about what the future will hold.
Indeed. Matter of fact, last night I drove just a short mile or so to the high school in Ukiah just to check on capacity and such. And that's where the numbers came from. About 50 spaces were still available for people, but they did not have a radio. So I went home and got him one of mine and loaned it to him. So So they're tuned in there to what's going on via radio. So Annie, to you.
Yeah, there was one in particular that I was interested in because I've always feared these theories that our law enforcement have, that they can give somebody a test and predict future criminality. And guess who they're usually thinking of when they do that? So you have story number 14, racially biased software to assess defendants' risk of committing future crimes. That makes my blood run cold.
Yes, and so this is a report that was from ProPublica, a great investigative outfit. In May of 2016, they reported how courtrooms across the country. So this is not police officers, but another aspect of the legal system, our courts. How judges in those courtrooms across the country are increasingly using these risk assessments that are generated by algorithms to rate a defendant's risk of future crime, and in many states, to unofficially inform their sentencing decisions. Now, this was first brought to attention as a potential social problem back in 2014 when the Attorney General at the time, Eric Holder, warned that so-called risk assessments might be injecting bias, and specifically racial or ethnic bias, into the nation's judicial system. And what the reporters at ProPublica did was they obtained risk scores that had been assigned to more than 7,000 people who had been arrested in a county in Florida between 2013 and 2014. And what the ProPublica investigators did is they went back to see how many of those who had been charged with new crimes over the next couple of years. In Broward County, Florida, the judges used risk scores not to determine sentences or to rate a risk of future crime, but to determine whether defendants are sufficiently low risk in order to be released on bail pending their trial. So that's still a very consequential decision. And what the reporters at ProPublica found when they looked at the data was that the algorithms that were being used, and this is specifically a program known as COMPASS, which is an acronym for the Correctional Offender Management Profiling for Alternative Sanctions, that the algorithm, the COMPASS algorithm, proved, in their words, quote, remarkably unreliable in forecasting violent crime. Just 20% of the people who had been predicted to commit violent crimes actually went on to do so. And the assessment by the ProPublica reporters was that the algorithm was only somewhat more accurate than a coin toss. Now, the element of racial or ethnic discrimination enters here when they noted that the formula, the algorithm, was particularly likely to falsely flag black defendants as future criminals, wrongly labeling them that way at a rate twice as high as for white defendants. The other twist on this story is that the company that produces the COMPASS algorithm that's used in Broward County, Florida, and other places around the country, they disputed the ProPublica findings. But as ProPublica noted, Northpoint, the company that created and administers the COMPASS algorithm, deems that this algorithm is proprietary, and so it won't publicly disclose any of the parameters on which the algorithm determines defendants' risk scores. So it's impossible, in other words, for defendants or the lawyers representing them to see and to figure out how there might be, how this might be impacting judges' decisions.
Well, that's
so. This is part of, I think, a larger pattern. If you look back at several of the last top 25 story lists that we at Project Sensitive produced, you'll find a number of stories where algorithms are increasingly making crucial decisions that affect things like judges' sentencing, how and whether we receive certain kinds of political messages when we're using our social media. And the kicker for me on these is that all these algorithms, because they're deemed proprietary, the producers of them will not disclose any information about how they operate. So we have a kind of a veil that masks the workings of these algorithms that in turn are consequential for our democracy, or in this case for our justice system.
Yeah, that's story number 14, if you want to go to Project Censored website and read more about that one.
That was projectcensored.org. I don't remember if that was clear earlier on when it was mentioned, but so projectcensored.org.
So, Steve, you had a few more that you thought maybe we could squeeze in another one?
Well, indeed. There was another three or four I'd like to highlight. So one of them is titled, The DNC Claims Right to Select Presidential Candidate. This is a story I followed closely at the time, just last year. So, yeah, what's the news on that?
Well, the news that people will probably be familiar with is that, of course, in July of 2016, WikiLeaks released some 20,000 Democratic National Committee emails that had been sent internal to the DNC between January of 2015 and May of 2016. And most of those emails originated from seven or so prominent DNC staff members. And those emails showed that instead of treating Sanders as a viable, Bernie Sanders as a viable candidate for the Democratic ticket, the DNC worked against him and his campaign to ensure that Clinton received the nomination. That much of this story, I think, is probably pretty well known to people who have followed the primaries and the aftermath of the primary elections. But the story that that placed this number nine on our list is reporting, especially by a journalist named Michael Sinato for The Observer. And what he documented was that in June of 2016, a legal firm based in Miami, Beck and Lee, filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of Bernie Sanders supporters against the Democratic National Committee and its former chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The allegation of this class action lawsuit was that the DNC had broke its legally binding neutrality agreements regarding the primaries by strategizing to make Clinton the nominee before a vote was cast. Now, this lawsuit may or may not come to anything, but the story here, I think, is what was revealed as the attorneys representing the DNC made their case before the court. So the things that I'm about to say or describe are from transcripts from the hearing of that lawsuit, which took place back in April. Among other things, one of the DNC's attorneys asserted that it would have been within the DNC's rights to, and I'm going to quote directly now from the court transcript, the DNC attorney, it would be within the DNC's right to go into back rooms like they used to and smoke cigars and pick the candidate that way. the attorney, Bruce Spiva, went on to say, that's not the way it was done, but they could have, and that would have also been their right. Again, I'm quoting directly there.
Mm-hmm.
Later, the DNC attorneys, later in the hearing, the DNC attorneys argued that specific language in the Democratic National Committee's charter, including the terms impartial and even-handed, could not be interpreted in a court of law. Right. So responding to that, the attorneys representing the class action lawsuit, the Sanders supporters, he was incredulous. He says, I'm shocked to hear we can't define what it means to be even-handed and impartial. And earlier, he had argued that the running of elections, that it was a bedrock assumption of the running of elections that they would be run in a fair and impartial manner. And that wasn't simply his opinion or anything like that, but that's what the DNC's own charter says. So I think the smoking gun here that maybe reinforces a sense that people already had, that many people already had, that a general sense that Sanders was robbed, and so forth and so on. The arguments made by the DNC attorneys that the Democratic National Committee had no obligation to run a fair and impartial primary, and that even if they did, no court could really adjudicate what it meant to be impartial or even-handed. Fairly depressing material for any of us who want to believe in the small d democratic process, right, with the DNC's own attorneys are making arguments like that in effectively a public setting.
Now, what's the status of the suit, though? So they made these claims in court and all, and then it's been sitting for some months.
Yeah, I have to confess that I have not been keeping track of where that case has gone. But the interesting thing that I can add is that these claims received almost no corporate coverage whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
The Washington Post, which was one of the few to have even a single passing article about it, mentioned it as a largely frivolous lawsuit. It was dismissed, in other words, by the Post. The other thing that I think is really interesting about this story, if we're talking about sort of the political ecology of news reporting in the United States, I mentioned Michael Sinato as one of the primary reporters, and he's in his reports, a series of reports he did on the early stages of this trial, he consistently used official documents, the leaked DNC emails, courtroom transcripts, as I've mentioned, as primary sources. But even his own publisher, The Observer, repeatedly identified his pieces as opinion pieces rather than straight news reporting.
Okay, I don't know. Do we have time to just touch on one more? We're just about out of time, but I was interested in number 7, the toll of U.S. Navy training on wildlife in the North Pacific, because locally right here that's affecting us in the intertribal Tsingkiyun Wilderness. The tribes are suing the Navy for that. So what about number 7 in a couple, like a minute or two?
Yeah. So that local story is part of a larger story, a larger pattern that Dar Jamal reported on for Truthout, drawing on data compiled by the West Coast Action Alliance, who looked at the Navy's environmental impact statements and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's letter of authorization, the NOAA authorization for training exercises in the Pacific Northwest. So this would be up the coast a ways from you all there in the Northern California coast. And what they found, what the West Coast Action Alliance found, was that over a 5-year period, the U.S. Navy was responsible for nearly 12 million so-called takes of marine mammal species. Now, a take is defined as a type of harm to an animal that can range from harassment that might result in behavioral changes for that animal all the way to the death of that animal. So if we're talking about over a 5-year period, nearly 12 million takes of marine mammal species, and people could go online and find either Dar Jamal's original reports or Project Censored Summary to get some of the details on that. But notice that these are marine mammal species. So that figure, that 11.8 million figure, doesn't even include endangered and threatened seabirds, fish, turtles, and other terrestrial species that would be impacted by these Navy training exercises.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's little to no oversight on these activities, and as a result, the public, with the exception of reports like Dar Jamal's for Truthout, is left in the dark, by and large, regarding the environmental impacts of things like torpedo launches, the testing and training of use of air-to-surface missiles and sonar, other types of Navy training exercises.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that original article was by Dar Jamal. One can search for it, but also the reference to it is online if one looks at the full article at the projectcensored.org website. So I think we won't have time to go into detail on the last two that interested me. And this is, again, out of a total of 25, which are in the book. Again, that's Censored 2018, available online or in local bookstores. And it is published by the Project Censored organization. The last two, I'll just mention the names of number 5 on your list, is the Big Data and Dark Money Behind the 2016 Election. Well, we cover that regularly here on the program and will in additionally in the future. So I'll just mention the name there for listeners. And also the number 4 after that is Voter Suppression in the 2016 Presidential Election. And that is another topic which I'll be discussing plenty of in future dates here on Corporations and Democracy. As a matter of fact, and maybe you heard that Greg Palast has an update of his movie that he did last year. about voter suppression and the interstate cross-check program and such. And he has an update on that, which is being published now or very soon in the coming weeks. And for listeners in the county, I hope to show that, at least in the Ukiah area, but hopefully in other locations around the county. So let me quickly ask what the timing is here for the next few minutes for an update. Shall we go to the top of the hour? Okay. So we'll go to the top of the hour, and then there will be an update on the fires. So let's summarize the Project Censored book, 25 titles, the news that didn't make the news in the last year, and available online at projectcensored.org. And any other comments you'd like to make, Andy?
Well, I think just that a lot of your audience will already be familiar with some of these stories. And again, that's testament to their desire to be informed and engaged, and to KZYX and specifically Corporations and Democracy for bringing these stories to greater attention. It's really easy to forget that a lot of the public doesn't actually know anything at all about these stories. And so I think there's part of the mission of Project Censored, and I understand us as being in solidarity on this, to try to increase understanding of these underreported stories in the hopes that as more people know, the outrage over these injustices and abuses of power will galvanize us into action, and we'll be able to create